This is the Freshman 15.
My name's Jeremy Bear, and I remember when Daniel Long was just some pissant kid with a shine box.
My name's Daniel Long, and I'm gonna pay him next week. I'm gonna pay him!
That was pretty good. Hey, Daniel, by the way, can you do me a favor?
Sure.
Would you mind going on back home and bringing back your fucking shine box?
Motherfucking!
No, dude, I was kidding.
So, Jeremy, here we are.
Hey, episode 30.
Big deal.
This is it. This is the season finale. Snuck right up, right?
I know. It really did. It feels like it's quick. I don't know if it feels like that to people who are listening, but
well,
it does.
Well, I feel like it felt like just the other day we were trying to figure out episode 15, season finale, and, you know, making the decision to do another season. And the season came and the season went.
And here we are.
Here we are.
I know, I can't believe it. So it is a big episode.
Yeah.
Before we get into it, though, I think we need to acknowledge the people who've been gracious enough to send us some feedback.
Oh, yeah, hey, listen, before you do that,
yeah,
though, I got to say something.
Do it.
We have an audience this time. Oh,
here they are.
Hey, how's it going, fellas? Real good. Two listeners decided to come in, not just listeners, good friends of ours, Pete Diebel, Jeff Gray.
Here they are.
Been with us since nearly the beginning. Fellas, thank you. You're not on mics, but you're in the background.
And you're faithful listeners. So grateful.
Good people. So, you know, you can tell what kind of quality operation we've got when, you know, come on in.
Anybody?
You want to sit and listen to us record?
Doesn't take much.
Anyway, I'm sorry. You mentioned feedback.
Yeah. So you have some to share.
You know, people had a few reactions. I received some texts, some in-person mentions and all that. It seemed like, well, okay, first of all, we're recording these episodes ahead of time. So the only feedback that we have to go on are from our Zack Snyder episode and before. By now, you'll have heard us talk about Darren Aronofsky, Guillermo del Toro. But as we record this, those episodes aren't out yet because, you know, we're trying to be responsible people and do all this way ahead of time. The Zack Snyder episode and the James Gunn special, both terrific feedback, some interesting conversations that I was able to have.
Mm-hmm. Me too. I actually got a couple quick comments about how they appreciated our James Gunn special.
Yeah.
Specifically, they thought we kind of engaged that topic well.
I always get nervous when there's like soul bearing, like when it gets too personal. Like, look, I don't want people to know I'm a dick, and yet there it is.
But
and
at
it's
some
out
point,
there.
At
but,
some point, people are going to know. And what are you going to do about it? No, but I think one of the things that people appreciated was we were kind of like, okay, here's where we are.
Yeah.
Can we have a conversation? Was kind of one of the big questions. And I think people were grateful for that.
Yeah. It's a recommendation of our, not just our listeners, but of the conversations that I feel like our culture is ready to have right now.
Absolutely.
So very grateful for it. I have a few comments from Facebook. And I'm not going to read all of them. One quick one regarding our Zack Snyder episode comes from our friend, Jen Mangloss. And she said, love the Sarah Polley shout out. Stories We Tell is one of my favorite films. I've watched it multiple times. And that's, of course, in reference to a comment you made, Daniel.
I love that film.
Yeah.
Honestly, if people haven't seen that movie, it's a great movie to discuss the art of documentary and I think the idea of memory.
Yeah. You know what? To my shame, I was unfamiliar with the directorial work of Sarah Polley, but in the months ahead, I definitely need to do that.
It's worth it.
Documentaries.
I think she has two other features.
Yeah, very nice. And by the way, as a quick shout out, and by the way, thanks for the comment, Jen. Jen has, with her podcast partner, has her own podcast about film, and this was just launched in the last few months.
So I didn't know about this until you mentioned it.
Yeah. The podcast is called Stories in the Key of Light. If that sounds a little difficult to discern exactly what it's about specifically, it's a film podcast, but their main topic of discussion is how it relates to spirituality, spiritual topics. You've probably, if you're a longtime listener of the Freshman 15, here and there, Daniel and I have sort of let you into our personal worlds a little bit. We've talked about our own spiritual take on a couple of things. It's not what we major on, but, you know, we've talked about it. If that's a sort of content you're interested in, by all means, Stories in the Key of Light, give a listen. They'd certainly love to have you. I enjoy it.
I can't wait to listen to that. I mean, it sounds like right up our alley, right? In terms of the types of things we want to engage with and talk about.
Yeah. Well, listen, again, this is episode 30.
Let's do it.
Daniel, this was a daunting task. When we were talking about doing a potential season two, this was kind of one of the first decisions we made. Am I remembering it wrong?
No. I think that is right. Where are we going, right? I mean, who's going to be the person that we talk about at the end? Especially if you're coming from Kubrick and you're going to start another volume or season.
Right.
You have to ask that question.
We landed on the great, the legendary Martin Scorsese as our season closer, which... holy cow. I have so many notes. There's so many things to talk about. Honestly, figuring out a way to sort of end the discussion is going to be the big challenge for this one.
Absolutely. Can I talk about one of the daunting things?
Go ahead.
Are we going to refer to him as Scorsese or Scorsese? Because I feel like that's all over the place in terms of how you talk about Martin Scorsese or Scorsese.
I feel like at award shows, it's Scorsese.
I feel like that's what it is too.
Oh man, this is going to be a long episode.
We're going to get into these nitty-gritty details.
But you know, I had not seen this particular Freshman film until we were preparing for this.
So I had seen it twice before.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. How far back had you seen? Now, of course, the movie that we're talking about, Who's That Knocking at My Door?
Who's That Knocking at My Door?
When did you first see it?
So the first time I saw it was actually in school, film school at college. We didn't have to see it for a class. I have such a high respect for Scorsese and his films. Yeah. When we started talking about his earlier films, I knew Scorsese because of Goodfellas.
Sure.
But I didn't know much beyond that. But then when we started talking about him as a filmmaker and all these different things about him, I'm like, I need to see his first film. So I went back and I just kind of made my way up to Goodfellas.
As in like you like watched forward? Like you started from the beginning and then just...
Yeah, I just felt like I wanted to do that or I had to do that.
Did you watch every film?
I wouldn't say every film. There were some of the musicals that I hadn't seen then and the documentaries that I didn't really watch. I've seen him since, but not at that point.
No kidding. All right. Wow. Yeah.
He's one of the filmmakers for me that made me start loving movies.
Yeah.
And made me want to start watching more and thinking about them.
Amazing guy. I mean, it's just the fact that he's still innovating at his age, 4 decades really.
I know, it's crazy.
Of innovative work. I mean, just absolutely astonishing, and by some accounts, still putting out maybe some of his best stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. I hadn't seen this Freshman film coming into this. My sort of impression was, okay, a really ultra lacking Freshman film, much like Kubrick, but maybe we see some groundwork laid for some interesting stuff later. Now, opinion spoiler. Clearly, yeah, it's one of his lesser films. I mean, you know, I don't think anyone could claim that this is his masterpiece or anything like that. But I think it's a little bit of short shrift to say, oh, this is just, he started off with a shit film and he just got better from there. There's a little bit more going on in Who's That Knocking at My Door than there is in, for example, Fear and Desire.
I think that's right. You know, it's interesting you say that because in film school, I felt like I was so blinded, I think, by my love for Scorsese that when I went back and watched Who's That Knocking at My Door, I couldn't detach the film from what I knew he would be. Mm. And so I think I gave it a lot more grace than I did this time around. I mean, I'm older. I feel like I just watch things differently. And then I just think, well, he doesn't really need that grace, right? I mean, you just kind of watch, you kind of go back and you watch it for the type of film that it is. So I feel like now, I feel really similarly to you, like it's lacking in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yet there are so many more threads from that to his entire film catalog than there are from Fear and Desire to Kubrick's. Which that's an interesting, I just feel like that's a really fascinating difference there between the two of them.
I think the thing that's really amazing to me is when you watch Who's That Knocking at My Door, Scorsese's obsessions were already apparent there.
All over it.
And I don't want to be too obtuse about this whole thing. For those who haven't seen it, which let's be honest, is going to probably be most of our audience. What is Daniel? Who's that knocking at my door about?
I mean, I think the easy premise would be there's a character named JR played by the great Harvey Keitel. Mm. He's part of some wise guys or possibly the mob, and they're having a great time and doing things and just being those type of people.
Yeah.
But then there's like a love interest, and he meets this girl. This kind of raises some conflict or tension in JR, because what you discover is that he has a certain type of ideal for a woman, in particular a type of woman who should be a virgin. That's the type of girl you marry. He discovers that she isn't, because she's been raped. And then all of a sudden the story is like this tension between the two of them. Can he reconcile his ideal of what he expected her to be versus what she actually is? A lot of other things happen.
Yeah.
But that's the story.
Yeah. And I would probably almost put in this case story in quotes.
Oh, absolutely.
It really is a movie of, and I think what you described is, yeah, loosely that is what happens. But it's sort of a film that's made of kind of it's a string of impressions almost, more than it is like this plot line that you follow. You mentioned like these guys that Harvey Keitel hangs around with being in the mob. That was one thing that I was sort of like struggling with back and forth. Like, was this like an organized crime gang, or was it just kind of a bunch of troublemaking 22-year-olds or something? It was kind of hard to pin down how criminal these guys were. Were they just, you know,
right?
How wise guy-ish are they?
You lose. What's wrong, Joey, huh? You lose because you're playing with my money. You're
poor. I'll show you. Don't you like to steal? Don't you like to steal?
You know, one of the reasons why a lot of people might think that Scorsese's first film is Mean Streets is because Who's That Knocking at My Door is actually basically like a blueprint,
yeah,
or a jumping off point for that film. I mean, there's some discrepancy. In your notes, do you have this movie as coming out in 1967 or 1969?
It's a good question, and I know why you ask, because there was different iterations of the film.
Right, exactly.
If you happen to come here through Facebook or Instagram and you've seen the graphics of early Scorsese directing this film that we've put up in our marketing materials, it was really interesting in the photo that we found of him. It was the Who's That Knocking at My Door set, and it was very careful to mention first year.
Yeah.
Because this movie was done in phases. And if you know anything about the history of how this film was done, really the material of Harvey Keitel screwing around with these guys sort of was the movie.
It was initially.
Yeah.
And people hated it.
I think it was sort of a film student-y kind of a thing. Yeah. I remember like way back when we were talking about George Lucas, this was kind of an avant-garde thing to do, was, you know, rather than getting tied down to plot, let's go down the road of, let's talk about texture and character and impressions and stuff like that and not tie ourselves down to plot. It's pretty clear that Scorsese wanted to do that. And there was some interest in what he was doing, but not enough to really sell the movie. So that's when the movie went into the phase two,
yep,
which was, let's see if we can get a girl subplot. Can we weave the two together? Mm-hmm. And you could tell these are very, very disparate plots, right, quote unquote, in the movie, because when you watch it, these two threads don't have much to do with each other.
No.
And then, of course, there was a final third phase where I want to say it was Roger Corman, mm-hmm, that Scorsese spoke to, and Roger Corman said, it's pretty good, but you need tits.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said.
So essentially, Scorsese...
Just put in 5 to 7 minutes and you'll be fine.
5 to 7 minutes, yeah. And there is this completely, I don't want to say completely nonsensical, but pretty nonsensical.
What do you mean it's not completely not? Well, I guess in the... No, it seems pretty nonsensical. Yeah.
Because they're having a discussion. He's having a discussion, Harvey Keitel, with his girlfriend about the difference between girls and broads. Mm-hmm. What's a girl and what's a broad?
Yeah, I really liked her in that picture.
That girl in that picture?
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you something. That girl in that picture was a broad.
What do you mean a broad?
A broad. You know, there are girls and then there are broads.
And you kind of get the impression that he's saying broads are the more slutty types, and, you know, he doesn't use those words. But then that sort of springboards directly into this kind of softcore scene.
It's so weird.
It's so odd.
And uncomfortable.
But yet you could see that Martin Scorsese is there saying, okay, look, if I have to have a scene like this in order to sell the movie, then it's going to be something out of Godard or something like that.
That's exactly what it feels like. Yeah, it feels like French New Wave, right?
Yeah, exactly. So he's like, okay, if you're going to make me porn it up, then I'm going to put as much art as I possibly can into it. And then it's back to the movie proper. Anyway, that was Scorsese taking Roger Corman's advice about how to sell the movie.
Which I think is important. So Roger Corman, a massive like producer of exploitation cinema.
Yeah.
So he knew how to sell movies because that's what you did, right? Yeah. You put in crazy violence, you put in sex, people are going to go see that because it's revolting against these social norms of the time.
Yeah.
And I think that you're right about Scorsese kind of taking a different approach to that, where in some ways I feel like that moment is similar to our conversation about, you know, Spike Lee episode and She's Gotta Have It, and okay, you're going to do this and you're going to try to do it artfully, but then it seems also problematic and weird and uncomfortable.
Yeah. And of course, there's the pragmatist in me at the back of my mind thinking, how is it that he could afford to put the Doors behind that sequence? I mean,
right.
You know, it was really...
Which
was
is
really
incredible
sort of
music choice.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the end, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, playing underneath that whole thing. Which is anti-erotic.
Oh, for sure.
You know, music coming in underneath this material that it's just like, I don't know, the whole thing is just so interesting. The framing's so interesting, the composition, the use of light and the contrast and all that. And it really adds nothing story-wise to the movie other than it's just this injection of this quote-unquote art. I don't know.
So, but I find it fascinating thinking about just maybe his evolution as an artist. I feel like this movie is a collection of moments, but he knows the power of the technical side of filmmaking and what happens when you put different images together and really well-formed and crafted images that people are going to try to make meaning out of them. So even though these feel like separate things, you still wonder, this is interesting, kind of included in a film about a person who's having a really difficult time with a girl who's not a virgin, yet he is clearly out doing whatever he wants with whatever woman he'd like to do that with. And there's this kind of tension raised between the expectation of what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a man. So I think it's still fascinating that he knows how to use the art form and not necessarily know how to tell a story.
Yeah.
But he will evolve into knowing how to do both. And that's when he's at his best.
Yeah. I kept trying to figure out in which places and in which ways was the movie kind of hamstringing itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd say the softcore scene, it does hamstring the movie. But there are other places where it's like, I see what you're doing. And I think you made a comment earlier. This was a blueprint. It's clear that Who's That Knocking at My Door was this sort of rehearsal for Mean Streets and everything that movie was, which, even Mean Streets, clearly a flawed movie, but leaps and bounds. I mean, you know, by the way, I love Mean Streets.
Yeah.
It's a great, great film. But this didn't know how to be that yet.
Mm-hmm.
It had the rudiments. Catholicism, yes. Crime, troublemaking, trying to understand what's a boy and what's a man?
Right.
Yes, absolutely. You know, all these things. How do I want to use editing? How do I want to use pop music and all that stuff? He's there trying to figure it out. And in that sense, I enjoy it. I enjoy watching that, knowing the artist that Scorsese's going to become. But yeah, the pop montages, they are too long.
Yeah.
The editing doesn't quite know what it wants to be.
No. I mean, almost never, actually.
Yeah. You can see moments in Who's That Knocking that I'm like, oh, that was done again, but successfully in Wolf of Wall Street and things like that. And you're just like, oh, that use of like freeze frame or something like that, or that use of callback editing, or, you know, in the middle of another scene, the whole continuity be damned quality of it that he really, really became known for. It's kind of cool to see that he was playing with it all the way back then.
No, I think that's so true. And three iterations of a film. Yeah. You have, like, I think he started at 1965, right? It is what it is by 1969. That's three different iterations of the same thing. I mean, you have to be somebody who's, like, absolutely tenacious to say, oh, that wasn't good in 65 or not finished. Okay, I'm going to try it again or complete it. Oh, it's still not up to it. Okay, right. I'm going to give it another shot. That's pretty remarkable. I actually heard an interview with him where he was talking about how somebody said, yeah, I think you're just going to have to consider the fact that some people want to be artists and just can't be. So yeah. What else are you going to do?
Right.
And he said that just didn't register with him. I'm a director. What do you mean? This is what I'm going to do. That tenacity of getting projects made and finished, even if you don't know it, that's what he's carried throughout his entire career.
Yeah.
All these passion projects that he's had for years and years and years that we've gotten to see have started probably 10 years before we actually have gotten to see them. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. So this is a topic that you and I have talked about a lot, which is directors that find their film in the editing. I was trying to figure out the right moment to sort of bring up this topic, but Thelma,
Schoonmaker, she's incredible. Honestly, Scorsese, and he would say this, he wouldn't be him without her.
I feel like Scorsese should be legally bound to whenever he accepts an award for anything that she should be standing next to him. Because, and again, whatever, you can disagree if you want. And I really, I'm a hyperbolic guy. Thelma Schoonmaker, greatest editor in the history of film.
No, I agree. I think that's right. One of the beautiful things about her art is that she is willing to simply do that.
Yeah.
She loves, if you listen to her talk about editing, that is what she wants to be doing.
Yeah.
She says, I have the greatest job in the world.
Right.
And so just to be clear, a lot of Scorsese films are highly improvisational.
Yeah.
This isn't like, oh, you had this shot in mind. Okay, so here's this shot with these scripted scenes. You're going to act them out. Okay, I'm going to cut. No, I mean, she, I think, spent 3 months on one scene from Raging Bull.
Right, yeah, with Pesci and De Niro trying to make sense of just endless improv.
This is about improvisation and the difficulties of cutting improvisation sometimes. In this case, he wanted to shoot in the actual apartment where Jake LaMotta had lived, and that house did not, the kitchen of that house did not allow for two cameras. My job as an editor was to take the brilliant improvisation between De Niro and Pesci, but all shot first for 2 hours on De Niro and then for 2 hours on Pesci, and try and make it seem like a scene, and it was extremely difficult. The material was unbelievably rich. These are the two greatest improvisers in the world. They spark each other off, and they're fearless.
So I'm curious, because I know this is what you do, and you edit. How hard would that be?
I mean, when you know, like, the story of the scene that you're talking about, which was, they didn't have the option of having multiple cameras in the room at the same time, so they had to essentially single camera it. But you're dealing with a lot of equipment. Film can be more complicated than what we have today, which is, you know, digital. Mm-hmm. You have these film mags that last for 10 minutes at a time. Not just coverage, but in some cases, hours of coverage of a single character.
That's crazy.
Hours later to go back and reverse the camera on an improv performance after you've just gotten 2 solid hours of Robert De Niro improvising with Joe Pesci, to swing that camera around and say, okay, do that same improv again, but now we're focused on Joe Pesci. You have literally no chance of getting anything that resembles any sort of coherent continuity. The fact that Thelma Schoonmaker understands the nuance of performance and the way the abstraction of a line can play off the abstraction of a following line, and knowing where and how to match those up so that you're not losing things like not just performance and not just rhythm, but also the nuance of, you know, what we're seeing in that film, which is like this sort of Italian-American vibe and, you know, the attitude and the tough guy-ness and all that. Scorsese even said later that she took months plural on that scene.
Yeah.
Just that scene. To have that sort of dogged commitment to making sure that that kind of scene is right, and holy cow, it's right.
It's an incredible scene.
It's amazing. It requires something a little more than human in terms of editing skill.
What are you worried about? What's the biggest thing you got to worry about?
You're worried about the weight.
You worried about the weight?
What are we arguing about for? I just said the weight.
Okay, let's say you lose because of your weight. Are they gonna think you're not as tough as you were?
You're not the same fighter?
Good! They'll match with all those guys they were afraid to match you with before. What happens? You'll kill them, and they gotta give you a title shot.
Bring me coffee, please.
Why? There's nobody else. Nobody's left. Who are they gonna give it to?
Coffee.
In a minute.
You listening to me?
Please, honey, bring me the coffee.
All right.
Oh.
Yeah, boy, how long I gotta wait?
Are you listening?
This is what I love so much about Thelma Schoonmaker. She doesn't really obey the classical idea of what a great editor is.
Oh, I can't wait to hear why.
She's just not really interested, because one of the main things that all editors need to understand when they go into that editing room is coherence of story, mm-hmm. definitely, mm-hmm. consistency, continuity, through line, all these sorts of things. Editors have to understand what these things are. They have to understand story. They have to know how to make continuity mistakes look intentional, and that's what they do. Thelma Schoonmaker, I don't want to go so far as to say she doesn't give a damn about continuity. Mm-hmm. She clearly does. Continuity is such a, for her, and this is just my own observation, it's such a low priority
yeah.
next to the art and the attitude and the rhythm of a piece. She's okay stuttering all of those things. She's okay with an edit that loops back on itself. Mm-hmm. She's okay with callback editing from a whole different scene or something like that. But the way that she's able to do it, the way that she's able to artistically grab hold of these rhythms, you know, in the same way that, you know, a song, or maybe even more appropriately, a DJ
right.
is able to take just a moment, a couple of seconds on a piece of vinyl that's from something that's completely unrelated and work it into a song in the exact perfect right way, that no, it doesn't fit in the sense that it fits, but it fits. There's something sort of higher than human about that sort of editing ability. Martin Scorsese has said, if the first cut of your movie doesn't make you physically ill, there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason that he says that is because he knows that he's working with the very best mm-hmm. in terms of editorial ability. He's going to find the most interesting performances. He's going to find the most interesting angles and moments. He's going to stutter that rhythm in such a way that he's going to just have options. I think I heard him talking about when he was shooting Age of Innocence, so many elaborate camera moves and so much elaborate art direction and all that. And you really don't have a choice. Yeah, you have to have a vision for where it's going to go. And by the way, he is very
detailed
in terms of storyboards oh, yeah. and those kinds of things. But ultimately, he knows the movie isn't really made on this piece of paper.
No.
It's made with him sitting in a chair next to his partner in crime, Thelma, and they're making these decisions. Fortunately, these two old friends are willing to try anything. It's just, it's such an amazing chemical marriage, and I could gush all day about the Scorsese Schoonmaker partnership. I mean, honestly, Daniel, it's Lennon and McCartney. It really is.
No, it feels that way.
Absolutely brilliant.
For sure, and I guess this is one of my questions. So I'm asking you this question. What type of freedom would you feel as a director determining what you want to try to do with the camera mm-hmm. and a scene, knowing that you have an editor who's going to find it? What you're going to try things.
Yeah.
I mean, what would that allow you to do? I guess that's my question.
I guess if you have the sort of faith in post-production that I think Martin Scorsese is able to have, not just because of Thelma, but also because of, you know, the years of experience,
of course,
the
yeah.
performances and the performers that he knows he's able to get. And actors will say this about being on a Scorsese set, which is, it's amazing how collaborative, mm-hmm. how much freedom there is to try anything. I mean, you know, you'll hear similar comments about like the Coens, which makes it amazing that the Coens somehow finish all their days early,
yeah.
which is bananas. But you hear, maybe not about the finishing the day early thing, but you'll hear similar things about Scorsese, which is, it's almost like working with like a student filmmaker or something, like just like the, there's this childlike eagerness to try all these things, to find a moment that you weren't going to find before. You know, he's the guy who's going to go into that boxing ring mm-hmm. and he's going to burn paper underneath the camera to see if it warps the image in a certain way that kind of makes something that's going to be interesting later. Maybe it won't. Maybe this is just a dumb thing that he's going to try. Maybe, or maybe it's going to be an Academy Award because he's discovered something that hasn't been discovered before. To be able to have that kind of freedom, I mean, is amazing. I'm lucky. I work with a great DP and mm-hmm. editor, and quite frankly, it's fun finding mm-hmm. things in editing that you never associating to moments that have no business being associated, you know? That's the joy. That's where so much of filmmaking is. That's where the art is, realizing that there was an intention underneath that scene that you didn't even realize when you were shooting it. It's the power of editorial.
And I love it. And I love because you watch a Scorsese film, I'd say, honestly, from Mean Streets on, you will see that you are watching a Scorsese film. And it's remarkable to me that that's true, knowing how much actors are allowed to improvise and collaborate. There's this relationship at work between Martin Scorsese and all the people involved. They're able to kind of play, find new things, and discover through acting and cinematography and editing this coherent piece of art. Like it's astounding to me, kind of doing this deep dive into his films and history to discover, wow, he's an auteur, right? He's an author of cinema, yet he's so open to what he allows to kind of influence his films and the people who are part of it. That's a really special thing.
It really is. I heard an interview with Leonardo DiCaprio, and the interviewer was asking him, so you not only act in these Scorsese films, but you also co-produce them and all that, which means that you have a certain amount of influence over the checks that get written and the mm-hmm. budget and that kind of thing. And the interviewer asked DiCaprio, so what do you do when mm-hmm. Martin Scorsese is going over budget? There's a shot that he really, really wants. He said, how hard is that for you as a producer to have that conversation with Scorsese about like, well, I don't know, Marty, that we can really afford that shot. Mm-hmm. And DiCaprio said, well, I would never say that to Martin Scorsese.
That's amazing.
And the interviewer said, really? And he goes, no, you don't. You just don't. It's not because he's a big and important guy and he's a great film. That's true. But the more important thing is Martin Scorsese is going to give us something mm-hmm. that we have to have.
Yeah.
He's a person that's been given a gift and he wants to give that gift to the world. Some trivial thing mm-hmm. like the budget on the day. If I'm going to let something like that deprive cinema from something that is potentially art and culture altering in the way that only Martin Scorsese is able to bring, well, that's a ridiculous choice.
Yeah.
I'm going to choose art and I'm going to choose culture and I'm going to choose Scorsese every time. And we'll figure out the money.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, it's not like Scorsese's a dope. It's not like he's going to, you know, double the budget because he's just, you know, he's going to be like a narcissist or something like that. He's just not that kind of guy. He's a responsible filmmaker, but you have to understand that there's certain moments that you have to catch lightning, and he's a director that knows when and knows how to catch lightning, and you've just got to be there and you've got to accommodate that.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that because I think one of the special things about Scorsese is that he has such high respect for filmmaking, the business, or what it makes possible.
Yeah.
Even if he has his qualms with it, right, and some of the things that he doesn't appreciate about it, he's not a guy who's like, you know what, screw everybody else. I'm just going to go and do this. He has pictures that he's wanted to do for years, and he's willing to find the best ways to do it within a system, broken or not, that will help him do it so that he can do it to the best of his ability, so that the most amount of people can see it and enjoy it and participate in it. I just love that.
Yeah.
He's an independent filmmaker in the way that he wants to tell the types of stories he wants to tell. Yet, he's also one of those classical, quote-unquote, filmmakers who loves the cinema.
Right.
And respects it for what it is. And I feel like that makes him really special as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that shouldn't be left out of the conversation, is the fact that Martin Scorsese is a person who is not just a great artist, but he's a great curator
mm-hmm.
of the history of film.
Oh, absolutely.
Encyclopedic knowledge of the history of film. If you've ever heard a lecture that he's given, or, you know, excerpts from Scorsese on Scorsese, where he talks about his influences, you know, if you've ever heard him give a commentary on Powell's The Red Shoes,
mm-hmm.
talking about the symbology and the color and the light and the ethereal quality of that film and how that's influenced so many things. And if you watch The Red Shoes, you might be like, well, okay, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting film.
Totally true.
But if you watch it through Scorsese's eyes, it becomes this transcendent thing.
Oh, it's so, yeah.
You see things that never in a million years would you have ever seen.
But what keeps nourishing me over the years in this film is the spell that the film casts. That is how it weaves the mystery of the obsession of creativity, of the creative drive. At the cocktail party, he challenges her with this line, "Why do you want to dance?" And she fires back, "Why do you want to live?" And so, in a way, it's the same as with art. It's not that you want to do it, it's that you have to do it.
It's because he sees not just film, but the history of film in a certain way, and he brings all of that to the table. I mean, I've had moments where I've gotten depressed.
Yeah.
Thinking about the fact that we only have so many more years of Martin Scorsese left.
I know, and here's the thing about Scorsese for me. The reason I love Kurosawa films is because of Scorsese. When I heard that the people who influenced him, I'm like, I need to watch them.
Right.
I'm thinking of Fellini and Antonioni, mm-hmm. and all these other people where I'm like, I wouldn't have watched their films.
Bergman, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Bergman. If I didn't know that they were direct influences on the types of movies he's made. And one of the things I love about at least a little bit of biography on Martin Scorsese is that he was a kid who, you know, had asthma.
Yeah.
He couldn't do a lot of things, at least actively. So he was stuck watching movies. He was stuck going to church and going to watch films. And what a gift. Yeah. I mean, what a gift that is for us, for people who don't understand the importance of history in this great art that we take for granted and love, but there's so much that's connected to it.
Yeah. Right?
And he knows how it's all connected.
Yeah.
And I love it.
And I'm sure there's, to a certain degree, you can probably relate to this as a minister. Scorsese, of course, famously flunked out of, mm-hmm. I want to say, seminary.
Yeah.
Maybe partly because he knew that cinema was his true calling. Maybe also because of his own struggles that he's been open about throughout the decades, mm-hmm. in terms of, like, you know, from a spiritual sense. How lucky are we as a culture that we get on celluloid those struggles
Absolutely.
That he has? How much has that meant? I mean, honestly, Daniel, how much has that meant to me and so many others in our own spiritual journey, mm-hmm. to be able to see some of those struggles up there on the big screen, to be able to talk openly about things that we're not supposed to talk openly about, maybe in some mm-hmm. cases. I don't know. I mean, I think it's more than just a history of film gift that Scorsese gives us. I think it's there's something heavier, maybe. I don't know. I realize this is what we do here, and mm-hmm. we talk about the impact on culture,
Absolutely.
And we talk about our love for these filmmakers and all that, but I don't hide the fact that the Coens are probably my favorite filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Some days, though, Martin Scorsese, I don't know. Some days I think maybe he's the guy. He is the important guy that I need, that we need, the filmmaker that we're supposed to have.
No, I think that same way. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I connected to him is this sense of calling that he's felt
yeah.
to create things that kind of push people to wrestle, to ask certain types of questions. And yeah. I think that he's done that in his career. I mean, that's one of the things he says, right? Is like, well, yeah, I flunked out of seminary, but the movies can be a pulpit too, you know, in that sort of way. But one of the things I love about it is he doesn't use it so much as a pulpit in terms of what people should be thinking or doing. He uses it as a way to say, like, I'm with you in it. I mean, one of the things I love, he just kind of documents or wrestles with the tension. You know, in the New Testament, you kind of have like these Jesus saying that there are these two most important things. You need to love God and love neighbor. And I feel like Scorsese says, isn't like the world kind of wrestling with how to do both of those things?
Mm-hmm.
Don't they seem at odds? Yeah, okay, so I have this religious life and I have this human life. And I don't know how like those two kind of reconcile or fit together. Yeah. I mean, you can see that all the way from Who's That Knocking at My Door? Like, okay, I have this Catholic religious part of me, but saying I need to love a certain type of person but then there's this person I do love
right.
who has this history and story. how do I reconcile those two things together? And I think all of his films actually kind of wrestle with some form of that.
Yeah.
And I totally resonate with that.
Yeah. And in some cases, like I would say, who's that knocking at my door? In some moments, in a ham-fisted way,
right.
Most definitely. But the fact that he's treading on that ground at all, though,
yeah.
is bedrock for the artist that he would eventually become. And again, far from my favorite of his films, but in that sense, I am grateful for Who's That Knocking at My Door. I am grateful for some of these early shorts. I don't know if you saw like The Big Shave, for example. Mm-hmm. Whatever, it's a nothing, and yet it's really something.
Right, exactly. You
know? These pieces of intrigue that he puts in there, the symbology that he's obsessed with. And that was something else I wanted to ask you about. So Who's That Knocking at My Door, mm-hmm. freshman film. What's a 2018 read on Who's That Knocking at My Door? Is that rude? Because
no,
it's got to be addressed, right? I mean, you know, there's things in there that's...
Oh, absolutely. A lot of the early Scorsese films kind of, they beg this question.
Yeah.
Specifically in terms of how they deal with women.
Yeah.
That can maybe is a question all throughout his catalog.
Sure.
But that's especially true in this film. There's such a clear perspective and identification of what it means to be a woman. And yeah. a woman worth a few things, right? Being respected, being worthy of marriage. There's certainly some racism mm-hmm. connected to the different characters and how they view people of color or of other cultures around them.
Right.
A 2018 read of Scorsese in general, he has a very limited understanding of women. I mean, would you yeah. say that?
See, here's the thing. I think yes and no. I think there's two approaches to it. I think you can look at Who's That Knocking, and you can also look at Casino,
right?
And even Wolf of Wall Street, and you can be like, oh, well, I'm not going to go so far as to say women are props or, you know, women are...
But in those two films, I think that's right.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Or women are more chess pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But before I go too far down that road, I think, yeah, but Alice doesn't live here anymore.
No, that's what I think. He you know, gets there, right? I
mean, he gets there.
That's what
Last
I think is
Temptation
fascinating.
Of Christ, even. Yeah. Wow. Okay. This is a more interesting, maybe a more sophisticated mm-hmm. idea of who women are. And so that brings me back around to maybe it's not a comment on women at all. Maybe it's a comment on male culture's comment on women, you know?
Yeah. Or even, that's one of the things I think is fascinating about Who's That Knocking. In that film, JR's perspective of women, religion doesn't help.
Right.
And I think that's really fascinating. So right. are these ideas of what a woman is supposed to be or not be or whatever, how much of that is JR's understanding
yeah.
versus, you know, he goes to the church at the end of the film and it doesn't seem like it doesn't seem to help at all.
Yeah.
But yet it's not like it's something that he's willing to completely negate or leave either. So, yeah.
So my first viewing of it, I'm like, okay, well, what's the lesson here? I just... Be willing to forgive your girlfriend when she tells you she was raped by
her. Forgive.
You know? I mean, and it just seemed like... And I think on certain level, you can't 2018 certain nuances of that. It's just that doesn't quite translate to this culture that we're in now. There might be things underneath some of that message that are a little more timeless that you know, I can be a little bit more forgiving about. But yeah, we're not, you know, at least I want to believe, we're no longer Harvey Keitel trying to figure out whether or not this raped girl has been spoiled for me.
Right.
That's gross, of course. Mm-hmm. But that ending scene, though, the bit in the church that does sort of suggest that Scorsese's back there saying, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know that's gross. I'm not trying to pretend that's not gross. Is that a comment on late 60s masculinity? You know, maybe. I don't know. So it's just, in that side of it, I appreciate. Of course, I want it to be done with a steadier hand, you know, without a doubt. And that steady hand is going to be coming later. But in some ways, that's it's a hard one to get around.
But I think you raise such a good point. Can you have a healthy exploration of masculinity in all different times, right? I mean, we have 4 decades of explorations of what it means to be a man.
Right.
Can you have that and an accurate portrayal of that? And even a filmmaker who maybe recognizes the problems in those different eras and still say, okay, well, here's a guy who clearly has a male perspective. I mean, we're not going to argue any of that. I mean, Alice doesn't live here anymore. it's certainly a divergence from that. But I still think that's a worthy task of saying, here's how men have wrestled with what it means to be a man.
Yeah.
In their faults and in the positive areas too.
Right.
And I think you're right. He does not shy away from the pitfalls or the downfalls of a man trying to figure out who he is in the context in which he's living.
Yeah.
And I think that's still an important task. Even if you can't kind of locate all the different nuances and how a man should be, you're still giving an accurate portrayal of the positives and negatives of where a man is. And I think that is important to know.
Yeah. And I feel like in some ways, Travis Bickle was his comment on a lot of that.
Oh, man. Absolutely. You know what
I
mean?
I think that's, in some ways, I feel like that was his acknowledgement of like, no, you're right. Mm-hmm. All this is a problem. Mm-hmm. In fact,
here's the epitome of that.
Yeah, here's the epitome of that problem. And the fact that you've got, what was his name? Hinckley? That his name? Looking at that character and saying, yes, I'm him, and acting accordingly, and, you know, so obsessed with Jodie Foster and trying to assassinate President Reagan and the whole thing because of his obsession with Travis Bickle, a very sad and unfortunate, but also a confirmation that Martin Scorsese was saying something, yeah, this is really, really ringing true in our culture, and he's commenting very frankly on the criticisms of his own male characters. So, yeah, I mean, I see something like that and I think, no, he gets it.
No, absolutely. I mean, the absolute loneliness of that character, and arguably a lot of characters in Scorsese's films.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
In terms of what is conveyed and understood, that film, how it's a remarkable piece of art, but it's also such a sad thing to watch.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you have some ideas or moments, at least in Who's That Knocking, that you feel like Scorsese is left behind. I mean, things that he did in this first film, right, that he maybe wouldn't do. I feel like we've kind of connected some of the things that he continues to do, some of the themes that he's kind of continued. But I do think that there are some things that he clearly is either refined or left behind altogether. So I'm curious your read on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it has to do with pacing.
Mm-hmm.
He's become, with the help of great editorial, he's become such a master of pacing and, I don't know, fat trimming, I guess, for lack of a better word, which isn't to say that his modern work is all like just the facts or anything like that. I don't mean that at all. But he's really, really learned the discipline, I think, of knowing what works and what's trimmable. And, you know, I think he purposefully shoots long movies with the intention of cutting them down. What I'm positive is painful cutting. It's not really a skill that he had yet. I see some of these moments. I see the early on in Who's That Knocking? This is the cynic in me. I feel like there's moments when you see at the end of a scene, things sort of freeze frame, or sometimes a freeze frame begins a scene and then goes into action. And there is a small cynical part of me that's like, you called cut too soon, didn't you? You didn't let in editorial, sometimes what we call handles. You didn't let your handles play out. You didn't let your handle set up the scene. You didn't let your handle play out. And whatever, your sound guy walked into the scene and stuff like, and you covered it by doing this freeze frame thing. And
yeah.
Now, maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it was legit, just an artistic editorial choice that you were playing with. It doesn't feel completely intentional every time. All that's gone later. And everything feels completely intentional. You know, even in moments that you know intellectually that can't be intentional, he's gotten rid of all that. So that intentionality of editing is maybe that's one of the most profound improvements, I guess.
No, I think I'm right there with you. And I can think of two specific instances. One is, while I actually think it's a really cool scene in Who's That Knocking, is at the train station between JR and the girl. They kind of meet. He sees that she's reading something in a French magazine, and it shows a picture of John Wayne from The Searchers, and,
right.
and you know, he's really intrigued. And I love what the camera's doing, right? Which is, it's clearly being cut from different sides of the line of action, but it's continually moving.
Oh, wait a minute. Was that the picture where Jeffrey Hunter's supposed to be trading Indian rugs, and he winds up trading for an Indian rod, and he doesn't know what to do with it?
That's the picture.
That's a good picture.
Good.
good. That picture was great.
Well, I'm not used to admitting I like Westerns.
Oh, yeah? Why not, huh? Everybody should like Westerns. Solve everybody's problems if they like Westerns.
Okay, I like Westerns.
Okay, then. Yeah, that was some picture. Some picture.
I think it's absolutely beautiful. I just think it goes on far too long.
Yeah.
And longer than Scorsese would let it go on now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there are so many moments where that's true, where you can see, like, he does this later. Yeah. There's that one weird music scene with where it kind of pans around the room of all the wise guys laughing.
There's yeah.
It just goes on.
It feels like he wants to finish the song.
Oh, my goodness. It goes on and on and on. So I think he leaves that behind, but I think it's perfected in so many other moments in his films.
Yeah.
And so this kind of gets into, I think, the question, or at least the idea of like these favorite moments, at least that I have, which I feel like coincidentally contain Scorsese's use of both filmmaking and use of music.
Yeah. Pop music sometimes and all. Well, we talked about this in advance. Like, yeah. We had a text exchange. What are some of your favorite Scorsese moments?
Do you want me to, how do we want to do this? You want me to list them off or what?
Well, yeah, I'm curious. So do you have, not just in this film, or maybe not in this film at all, but just across his body of work, do you have a handful of?
I have a top five Scorsese moment.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to count down. How does that sound?
I love it.
Okay. So here's my fifth, at least favorite. And it's hard to do this with a guy who has, like, I mean, so many different films. But here's my fifth favorite one. It actually comes from The Departed.
Okay.
And I love the sequence where it's kind of like a trick, where it's not necessarily the credit sequence, but it's the title sequence.
Titles.
The moment when Martin Sheen tells Leo's character, Billy Costigan, to go back into prison.
Right.
And then all of a sudden the Dropkick Murphy song comes
on. Right.
Oh, and it just shows this montage sequence of his time in prison, and but then also Sullivan's time getting I just think that's such a great moment.
The left to right dolly
it's
throughout.
So good. I mean, another favorite moment of mine is Mean Streets. I love Johnny Boy's entrance with the girls, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have Charlie, who's like, again, the music, right? It kicks in.
All the time.
All the time. I feel like that's such an important moment.
Which one do you want? Which one do you want? I want the wine trouble one. She's nice. I like that one.
The one?
She the one on the left? Nah, she the one, nah. What, your left or my left?
We both stand the same way.
Well, I don't know.
Hey, girls. You know, that little business is talked over. Everything's okay now.
Excuse me for a minute. Hey, Tony, you think maybe you could put this on the tab? Because somehow before, you know, and it would be, you'd be doing me a favor, you know?
Huh? Big tab or little tab?
Well,
don't you think it's better that you should put it on the small tab so that it balances out with the big tab?
Oh, so things even out.
Yeah, right.
I love the Raging Bull sequence where Jake LaMotta is just getting pummeled by Sugar Ray.
Yeah.
But just the editing there again, like we're talking about that. It's so amazing. I think my number one, though, and it seems silly to put it in there, but I love the Are You Talking to Me?
Of course.
Yeah, I feel like that scene is such an incredible moment of getting into the mind.
Yeah, of Travis Bickle. Oh,
yeah, it's so good.
You talking to me? You talking to me? Well, who the hell else are you talking? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. Who the fuck do you think you're talking to? Oh, yeah? Huh? Okay. Huh?
If it's not the most iconic scene Scorsese's ever shot, it's up there.
Oh, it's so good. But then the Copa scene. Right. I think that's my number one.
The Copa? The Oneer?
The Oneer.
Yeah. For those who don't know what Daniel's talking about, maybe the most legendary, and we talked about the Oneer, back in our Steven Spielberg episode. Yep. Go back. But the one long tracking shot behind Ray Liotta and his girl that goes from the street down the basement, through the kitchen, into the copa, and you see everything in the world peripherally that you need to see in that one shot. And it's one of the most beautiful choreographed things in film.
The whole idea is that it had to be done in one take, so you don't feel that it was a series of cuts or that there was a separation between him and the world that he was trying to get into. The camera flowed through and just glided through this world. Just all the doors opened to him and everything just slipped away. It was like heaven. And then to emerge like a king and queen, this was the highest he could aspire to.
And if you think P.T. Anderson, whom I love, did it first in Boogie Nights, this is where he got it from.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, speaking of Scorsese tributes and Boogie Nights, final scene in Boogie Nights and the final scene in Raging Bull.
It's the same thing.
It's the same scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So wait, yeah. What are yours?
Oh, and it's funny. It's a couple of yours are tangential to mine, but yeah, I did a top five course Scorsese moments. And I don't know why this moment has always just nailed me. There's a moment in Gangs of New York, the funeral procession. Leonardo DiCaprio steps out of line and gets in the face of Daniel Day-Lewis, and he says, challenge.
Challenge.
Challenge accepted.
The gravity of that exchange you don't get until the end of that movie.
Oh, man.
That you realize that that moment has redefined the course of the Five Corners. Yeah. It's just that what seems like an insignificant exchange, two powerful actors that really bring that home. Challenge accepted is one of my favorite moments in his films. I love it and I hate it. The scene between Robert De Niro and Juliette Lewis in Cape Fear.
Okay, so this was almost on my list.
Oh.
So the reason why it's hard to put it on a list is because obviously of what happens in the content. But the reason you have to put it on
a list
because of why you wouldn't want to put it on a list.
It's one of the most uncomfortable things in film. To call it a car crash that you can't look away from is to way undersell it. It's just, it's the most wince-inducing thing that you can imagine because you're imagining yourself as a father, thinking of your daughter in the room with Robert De Niro playing the character that he's playing in Cape
but
Fear.
But let's talk about, I love this scene so much, and I love it because of some of the blocking of it. So right? I mean, you have the power differential shift from Juliette Lewis standing to Robert De Niro sitting to this move. Clearly, he's the one in control by the end of the scene.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know it's going to go there.
Right.
But when it does, and then her acceptance in some ways of it is like...
It's one of the most psychologically searing scenes maybe I've seen in film.
Probably YouTube it.
Oh my gosh. Robert De Niro and Juliette Lewis in Cape Fear in the high school stage. Just unreal.
You thought about me last night, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
I know. Do you mind if I put my arm around you? It's okay.
No, I don't mind.
Another one, and again, this is maybe over obvious, but Am I Funny to You?
Oh, it's
from
so
Goodfellas.
Good.
Right. I mean, it's just, it sticks with you. It's in a film of 1,000 beautiful scenes. This is one of the most memorable things. Again, I mean, even at the front, we were talking about the shine box, and we all remember. And we all also remember the Am I Funny to You scene. Perfect example of an improv scene. Joe Pesci's got to be one of the greatest improv artists in the world.
No, seriously. It's
amazing.
Amazing.
By the way, that look on Ray Liotta's face, that is not an actor. That's Ray Liotta trying to figure out what the fuck in
that
moment.
Incredible.
That is completely 100% legit.
It's funny, it's a good story. It's funny. You're a funny guy.
What do you mean? You mean the way I talk? What?
Just, you're just funny. It's, you know, the way you tell the story and everything.
Funny how? I mean, what's funny about it?
Just,
what?
Just, you know, you're funny.
You mean, so? Man, let me understand this, because maybe it's me, I'm a little fucked up, maybe. But I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
But no, just, you know how you tell a story, what?
No, I don't know, you said it. How do I know? You said I'm funny. How the fuck am I funny? What the fuck is so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
Get the fuck out of here, to Tommy.
You motherfucker. I almost had him. You stuttering prick here. Frankie, was he shaking? I wonder about you sometimes, Henry. You may fold under questioning.
One of my favorite scenes also, and this wasn't true until recently when I rewatched it, and it was so powerful. The conversation between Saul/Paul with Jesus Christ.
I think that's a good one.
Yeah, in The Last Temptation of Christ, such a powerful moment. What can be a difficult, frustrating, slow burn movie that leads to this sort of crescendo that is, speaking honestly, for me, very satisfying, but it's a hard walk sometimes to get there with that film. But that conversation between Paul and Christ hears all of these things being said by Paul to the crowds around, and he overhears it, and he's like, wait a second, he's saying things that aren't true. And Willem Dafoe, as Jesus Christ, goes up to him and says, you're lying to these people. I should know. I'm Jesus Christ. I didn't do and say the things you're saying that I didn't said. Paul essentially says, well, that's okay.
I don't care whether you're Jesus or not. The resurrected Jesus will save the world, and that's what matters.
Those are lies. You can't save the world by lying.
I created the truth out of what people needed and what they believed. If I have to crucify you to save the world, then I'll crucify you. And if I have to resurrect you, then I'll do that too, whether you like it or not.
I won't let you. I'll tell everyone the truth.
Go ahead.
I tell you, that moment, it throws me into self-reflection every time. And it just, in terms of my own faith and in terms of just my relationships with the world around me and all that, it's just, it's such a cut to the bone moment. And you can just see Willem Dafoe, the look on his face where he's trying to navigate it. And of course, this is all in the context of the last temptation that Christ experiences on the cross. And it's a hard thing to get into without over-explaining, but what an amazing, searing moment that is between Paul and Christ.
I think one of the reasons why I find it important is because I think people undervalue the power that Paul had. But you wouldn't have Christianity if you didn't have Paul.
Right.
And I think that scene, and it's trying to get at that. And I think we talked about this a little bit before, which is Scorsese's interest in religious reality and what it means to be a human being.
Yeah.
I love it. I love that you picked that.
Yeah. Finally, and this is probably closely related to one of yours, You Never Got Me Down, Ray.
Oh, man.
There's so many things wrapped up in that line. Jake LaMotta, he knows he's done wrong. He's throwing the fight. He's going up against this clearly inferior boxer, and there's pride and there's despair and there's self-hatred at the fact that he's doing the thing that he promised himself he would never do, which is to take a fall in the ring. He knows he has to lose, but it's important for him in that moment to tell him, just so you remember, you never got me down, Ray.
So good.
You never actually knocked me out. I want you to remember this moment. You didn't actually win, no matter what the judges say. It's the picture of a tortured man, but at the same time, he's trying to hold on to the last thing. It's just that it's the Jake LaMotta story in Raging Bull is one of the great stories of cinema.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like it's kind of the quintessential moment of that story, for me anyways, is You Never Got Me Down, Ray.
Yeah, it's such a good moment.
And when I say that, I mean Jake wouldn't want to quit. He wanted to go.
Hey, Ray. Never went down, Ray. You never got me down, Ray. You hear me? You never got me down. Yeah? See? Look.
He can't not take a beating.
Yeah.
I mean, his whole life has been a beating.
Exactly. And there he is eventually. He's the elephant man.
Yeah.
I'm not an animal.
Right.
In his cell.
Why are you doing? Why? You're so stupid. You're so stupid. So fucking stupid. You're so stupid. I'm not an animal. I'm not an animal. I'm not an animal. Oh, you want to treat me like this? I'm not that bad. I'm not that bad.
I want to talk about our favorite Scorsese films, but clearly, you know, we can't do the
we're going to rank them all.
We can't do the Kubrick thing and rank them all because so that's a fool's errand. There's too many.
There are so many.
Holy cow, man. I mean, I think I counted them up yesterday. What are we talking about? 30 plus films?
Dude, 30 features? Plus. Yeah, it's crazy. And just all different types.
Yeah. He's basically done just about everything. So I do want to get to what you feel and what I feel are the best of the best. But Mrs., did Scorsese have, now I don't want to overset this up, while I don't think that he ever completely screwed up or anything right. like that with any film that he's ever done, there's some that I think he did go astray a little bit. I was wondering if you felt the same. Do you have any examples where you're like, I don't think he was making the right movie in this case?
Thinking about this was really hard for me. I think that there are certainly a lot of moments in this film that are misses, and but a film entirely, it being a miss, it's hard for me to categorize. But I did.
Okay.
And I gave it a shot. So some of the films that I don't think work as well as he'd like, even though there are parts of them that I love, I think New York, New York is one of those.
Right.
Well, even before that, I think Boxcar Bertha is a film that's a miss.
He was full Roger Corman.
Absolutely. I don't think it was the film that Scorsese wanted to make next. It was the one he had to make so that he could make his third film.
And when you watch Boxcar Bertha, there is a side of you that's like, how is this a Martin Scorsese film exactly?
Know.
You know, I mean, you can see things, but it's odd.
Most of these men have been eating wild greens since August. Islet tops. Weeds like cow's eat.
Well, I want something I ain't ever had.
How are you going to get that?
Guts and luck.
Luck? Hell. Luck is being a Vanderbilt or a Carnegie.
Just grabbing something good when it comes by.
A movie that he made that confused me is Shutter Island, actually.
Okay.
I'm not saying I dislike it.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot about that movie that I think is really interesting, but I'm really curious, and I actually haven't done a lot of like diving into his thought process about why he chose to make that movie and what about it connected with him. So that was just a surprising choice.
Yeah, and same for me. Boxcar Bertha, I'm just going to just flat call it my least favorite Scorsese film.
I think it's, yeah.
I can't say I hate the film because it's executed decently. Speaking frankly, it's the one I care about the least.
That's a good way to put it, I think.
I'm going to go so far as to say, and I'm in agreement with you on New York, New York. There are things in New York, New York that I think are actually really cool. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I'm glad I saw that. I'm glad that that's there. That's there. I don't think it's the movie he necessarily should spend his energy on, though. I wish I had a better way of putting it, but yeah, New York, New York, Scorsese's take on the musical, essentially.
It's like Scorsese saying, I want to acknowledge my love for the musical.
Yeah.
Here's what I'm going
to
do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when it's right up next to something like Mean Streets or Raging Bull or, you know, Taxi Driver or something like that, and right in the midst of all that, you're throwing New York, New York in.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today.
I wouldn't, there's a couple others that I wouldn't necessarily call misses by any stretch, but to me it's not maybe the best use of Scorsese's time. Hugo.
Yeah, okay, I think
liked it. Really liked it, in fact, but there was a part of me that's like, okay, cool, great. Can we get back to the real
right.
the real stuff here? And that's hard for me to say because there are moments in Hugo that I just absolutely love.
They're magical. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I love what the movie says.
Mm-hmm.
I love the history that it explores. I think that's really cool.
We risked everything. We sold the theater and everything we had so we could build our own movie studio.
Excellent.
And so the great adventure began.
I enjoyed Hugo, just not my favorite, not what I think he does best.
No, absolutely. I have a soft spot in my heart for that film.
You do?
I do.
All right, well, you know, to each his own.
I don't disagree necessarily, but I understand what you're saying.
I actually really liked a lot of Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. I liked the intention of it. I think it was great. I think there are sections where the movie is trying to figure out what it is.
Yeah.
That's another one where I feel like I'm not going to call that a miss by any stretch, but every so often, you know, I think, okay, you're feeling this out and a little unsure here and there, but overall, I think it's a great movie. I really, really like it, and I like what it's doing. I think it's an important movie for his
right.
body of work.
You don't like me very much, do you?
Not very much, no.
Honey, that's okay. I've been dumped on by kings in my time.
Look, Flo, I really don't need anybody making speeches for me, so I would appreciate it if you'd just leave me out of your jokes, okay?
Jokes? What jokes?
Well, the little routine you do for the fellas, just leave me out of it.
Well, honey, I sure would hate to have breakfast with you every morning of my life.
Don't have to worry. There's not much danger of that.
Put it this way. If you were making that movie now, I'm really interested in that movie.
Right. I think that's a good way of saying it. So I have a whole category, which we didn't talk about,
yeah.
like On the Fence. So Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore is on the fence
on
for
the
me.
Fence. Okay, great.
So Age of Innocence.
Mm-hmm.
On the Fence.
On the Fence, okay.
So there's a lot I actually love about that movie.
Oh, yeah, man.
So much of it. I don't know if I would have put it on the fence until you said, is that the type of film I'd want Scorsese to put his time to?
Yeah, yeah.
It makes me rethink that idea.
I'm glad you bring this up because you and I also talked about overlooked movies,
mm-hmm.
underrated movies, because that was one where I was on the fence about whether or not to include it in that list.
Right.
Which was Age of Innocence.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been my feeling in general. I'm like, I don't know, what do I think? Is that even a Scorsese movie? It is, but I have to tell you, recently watching the Criterion restoration of that movie, I kind of loved it.
That's incredible. So it helped you?
Kind of helped. It really did. Seeing that restoration, seeing that new sort of sheen on the whole thing, put it this way, I completely get what you're saying. I would encourage you to check it out, though, if you have the chance.
But even kind of going back to it recently, I still feel so conflicted about it.
Yeah.
And not because it's a bad film. That's the thing, it's hard to talk about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just in a body of work.
Oh, yeah.
You can't help but think about it in context of these other things.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean about Age of Innocence. It's hard to know where to put it.
It is. But there are things in that movie, and there are performances definitely in that movie, and there's nuance in that movie that, for me, it makes it very hard to discount.
Whatever it may have been, Newland, I can't have my happiness made out of a wrong to somebody else. If promises were made, or if you feel in some way pledged to this person, even if it means her getting a divorce, then Newland, don't give her up because of me.
There are no pledges. There are no promises that matter. That's all I've been trying to say. There is no one between us. There is nothing between us, May. Which is precisely my argument for getting married.
So here's some of the ones I want people to watch. And the two that come to mind immediately are King of Comedy and After Hours.
Yeah.
I think those two films.
Can I tell you something?
No, please.
Love with a capital L, King of Comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Love King of Comedy.
It's so good.
I want people to see King of Comedy. And I think you see an ad for it or a poster of it and people are like, yeah, that's not, it looks like B-movie-ish. It's freaking brilliant.
No, it's incredible.
Jerry, I just want to say one more thing, Jerry. I'm glad what you did to me today. You know that? Because now I know I can't rely on anybody. Not you, not anybody. And I shouldn't rely on anybody.
Right.
You know that? And you want to know something else? I'm going to work 50 times harder. And I'm going to be 50 times more famous than you.
Then you're going to have idiots like you playing your life.
I don't know if filmmakers would say, oh, that was an influence. But I can't help but think it's such an influence.
Yeah.
There's actually some of this awkwardness and...
Yeah.
This weird love, fascination, obsession between characters
right.
that I see in the film language
yeah.
that I can't help but trace back to that.
Before I even saw it, my thought was De Niro is a comedian, and then you watch it and you're like, okay, I still feel that way, but De Niro is that comedian?
Oh my gosh.
Brilliant.
So freaking brilliant.
It's great. No, I love it. I'm a King of Comedy fan for life.
Yeah, so King of Comedy, After Hours are certainly underrated, overlooked. I think a movie, we're not going to do top 10, but it would make my top 10.
Okay, I feel like I know what's coming, but I want to hear you say it. Go ahead.
Bringing Out the Dead.
I knew it.
You did?
I knew it. I could tell by the look on your face, yeah. Bringing Out the Dead. First Scorsese movie I saw in the movie theater, actually.
Wow, yeah. Awesome. It's so important in terms of, I think, Scorsese's exploration of death
yeah.
and memory and yeah. and religious symbolism and all this stuff. Not to mention, it's one of Nicolas Cage's absolute best performances.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's great. He was the guy to pick for that.
You're a lucky lady. How are you doing?
I'm driving out of myself.
Now your brakes are shot.
Taking that into consideration.
Frank! Frank! Yeah. Are you okay?
Never felt better in my life. How are you?
I have a theory that every director since Bringing Out the Dead has wanted Nicolas Cage to be that guy, but hasn't really known how to bring that out of him.
That's great. Now I think that's right. That film, yeah, I think people need to watch it.
Yeah, almost like an anthology feel to that film. Like each segment, each shift is its own sort of movie within a movie.
Yeah,
but,
it's true.
And you're right. You know, you can't call it his best film or anything like that. But it's kind of essential, though, in a weird way.
So, yes, give me some of yours.
Underrated. You know what? Top of my underrated list was Bringing Out the Dead.
All right.
I completely agree. And I did also put Age of Innocence on there.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Particularly with this Criterion transfer. Really, really nice. And if you happen to have the opportunity to watch any of the extras about the making of, some really cool insights into the making of that film. I got to tell you, man, and I'm the only person I know who feels this way. I really like Shutter Island. I know it's strange, but I feel like the first time I saw that film, I was like, what? Come on. Scorsese does M. Night Shyamalan? I don't know.
that's right.
You know, and then I went back to it later because it's Scorsese, and I said, okay, all right, are you giving me everything I need?
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't really escape that he kind of was. He was giving us all the clues that we needed for that ridiculous, wacko twist ending.
So I think one of the reasons why it's been hard for me to return to,
yeah,
and I think it's actually the reason that it makes it a Scorsese film, is the ending.
Yeah.
The twist, the Shyamalan-esque moment is fine. But what makes it Scorsese is the reason that man is haunted.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, for me, was so hard. So I think that's one of my conflicted kind of relationships. I don't think it's a bad movie.
No, I hear what you're saying, though, because it's just, you want a movie that's dealing with that towering a situation to be something more than like a twist thriller.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't change the fact that it's a twist
thriller. No, absolutely.
It's all, that is what the movie is.
They're experimenting on people here. I don't know, boss. How do you believe a crazy guy?
That's the beauty of it, isn't it? Crazy people, they're the perfect subjects. They talk, nobody listens. I stood at Dachau. We saw what human beings are capable of doing to each other, right? For Christ's sakes, we fought a goddamn war to stop them, and now I find out it may be happening here, on our soil?
So what are you really here to do, Ted?
Yeah, I've got a soft spot for Shutter Island.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it really is. For me, it's sort of Scorsese comfort food. I don't go to it for the same reasons that I go to, like, Raging Bull, for example. I don't know.
Yeah.
Only other one I had on that, on the overlooked Scorsese gems, Silence.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about to include that in Overlooked, but I guess that's right.
Yeah. I mean, and I realize that's kind of strange because it's his most recent movie, but I feel like people sort of passed it by and said, oh, yeah, it's another good one. Return to Silence.
No, I think that's right.
Yeah, it's really something.
Our religion does not take root in this country. Plant a sapling here and the roots rot.
There was a time when Christianity here grew and flourished.
When?
When? In your time, Father.
Rodriguez, please listen. The Japanese only believe in their distortion of our gospel, so they did not believe at all.
So, Scorsese is, of course, also known, not as well, but also known for the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Curious. You have a favorite Scorsese documentary?
So I have two.
Go ahead.
My Voyage to Italy.
Ah.
I love that movie.
Yeah.
Partly because of what it introduced me to, right? But through Scorsese's eyes. Like, sure. That's one of the cool things
personal
about it. Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
If you want to get connected to, like, that culture in Italian cinema,
mm-hmm,
watch that movie. I think it makes you love movies.
Yeah.
And it helps you see a person who's been informed by film.
The miracle is about the question of faith. And it's a running theme in Rossellini's work at this time. I think he was trying to ask the question, how can faith survive World War II and the horrors of the Holocaust?
And then I love No Direction Home.
Mm.
I mean, I'm a big Bob Dylan fan.
Sure, yeah.
Just the way that the music's used and the things I learned. I love that.
Man, I can't make it tonight. I don't know how to cover up for it. It's something I never figured out. There's nothing I can do about it. I just shouldn't be singing.
I think I'm going to get me a new Bob Dylan next week.
Get me a new Bob Dylan and use him. Use the new Bob Dylan. See how long he lasts. He brags of his misery.
So for you.
Speaking honestly, I think the one that I was most drawn into probably is his George Harrison documentary.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe part of it is because I've always been intrigued by George Harrison. Like the rest of the world, I've been a Beatles guy since high school, but I feel like I almost have to warn people before they see it. It's you know, how they say, be careful about meeting your heroes. Things that you're able to learn about George Harrison, you can't unlearn. But I appreciate it because it gives you a really full picture of the man and the career and all that. Just really, really nicely done.
I heard that Olivia Harrison was interested in approaching us to talk about a possibility of a film of some kind on George Harrison. I think she understood that if we were to do it, we would have kind of freedom in doing what we needed to do. One has to deal with a formative period in the Beatles. But this film is not about that. It's about George Harrison.
Even though I know this isn't true, Scorsese documentaries feel like side projects for mm-hmm. him, you know, mm-hmm. Even though I'm sure he puts just as much passion as he does into anything he does. But just watching the George Harrison documentary and being like, wow, even when he's doing a thing that isn't his main thing, he's just absolutely killing it.
Yeah, that's right. The thing about the documentaries that I think are fun to at least consider, even if you don't watch them, just to look at the catalog, say, wow, this guy's interests so connected to music.
Right.
Which I think is important to know if you're going to watch a Scorsese film, is like, he can't think of images disconnected from the music that's going to be behind him.
Who's that knocking at my door? I mean, you have to wonder which of these songs were in his head while he was shooting, you know?
Totally.
He'll throw in a soundtrack that contrasts rather than complements what you're seeing sometimes.
Oh my goodness, right.
Really, really interesting how he does that. You see like Tarantino taking inspiration from that later on in his films, where he'll choose something happy and upbeat to be playing underneath something that's extremely raw and visceral or something like that. And the opposite, you know, sometimes you'll see something that just feels what should be light and happy, but there's something ominous underneath. And Scorsese's able to do that with pop songs somehow. Just, you know, sometimes the most violent episode will be scored to the most, I don't know, major chord upbeat thing that you can possibly imagine. And somehow that adds dimension to it rather than interfering with it.
I mean, you think of that Goodfellas scene, right? Where all of a sudden all the people that have been offed and found,
right,
is this montage sequence with this incredible soundtrack. I can't even remember the song. I just know the feel of that scene.
So Daniel, you and I had a text exchange before we got here tonight, and we said, you know, we're not gonna take on the task of ranking every Scorsese movie, but do you have a top five? And I was able to do it.
I was able.
But not without including some honorable mentions.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, you have to.
Yeah, but I wondered what you came up with.
Okay, so I'm going to name my top five and then I'll name the honorable mentions.
All right, go ahead.
I'm going to start with number five, King of Comedy.
Yes.
Which we already talked about. I think it deserves to be up in the top.
Yeah.
Number four, Mean Streets.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful film. That it's his third film is remarkable to me. I think he's such a fully developed, realized artist by that film.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me.
And the priest gives me the usual penance, right? 10 Hail Marys, 10 Our Fathers, 10 whatever. Now, you know that next week I'm going to come back and he's going to just give me another 10 Hail Marys and another 10 Our Fathers. And I mean, you know how I feel about that shit. Now, that may be okay for the others, but it just doesn't work for me. I mean, if I do something wrong, I just want to pay for it my way. So I do my own penance for my own sins. What do you say, huh?
Three, Taxi Driver.
Okay.
I came to that film late, but I don't know. I felt like it was such a brave, courageous film to make.
Yeah.
Technically, artistically, I thought it was such a beautiful way of doing that.
All the animals come out at night. Whores, skunk pussies, buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies. Sick. Venal, Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets.
2 and 1 are hard for me, so I'll name them together. But this is the order I put them, 2 and then 1. Goodfellas and Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm.
To me, those films are, I don't know, they are Scorsese. They're perfect in terms of the ways that he connects both the technical aspects with the character.
Yeah.
I don't know if there are 2 better films to describe the movies that he's capable of making.
Yeah.
And when he's at his full capacity, employing every possible thing he can to describe the types of characters he wants to explore.
Yeah.
Those are 2 films I think are at the top.
Yeah.
Honorable mentions, I already named 1, and I do think it's on my top 10, Bringing Out the Dead.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think people, they argue about whether or not he's repeating himself, but I just found it, I loved it, was The Departed.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that's an honorable mention in terms of it being, I don't know. I feel like it's such a high caliber movie.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and it's wonderful in so many ways for me. So, yeah.
No, perfect. That's great. All right, well, I'll do the same.
Yeah, tell me. I mean,
top 5.
Can't wait.
So my number 5 was the hardest because it kept flopping. Ultimately, I'm going to give 5 to Taxi Driver.
Okay. All right.
It's too important a movie. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the movie that I kept flopping back and forth with was Taxi Driver and The Aviator.
Oh, yeah.
I can't help it. I rewatched it recently, and I think I saw maybe some of the flaws that I didn't see when I first saw it, but it's a near flawless movie, though. Mm-hmm. It's just so great, and it's still a Scorsese movie. I mean, it's perfect in so many ways.
Yeah.
I understand you're under a lot of pressure, but it's going to do me no good if you crack up on me like that. All right? Look. Take a couple hours off, all right? You relax a little.
Okay.
See your wife.
Okay.
Should have shown me all the blueprints.
All right.
Show me all the blueprints.
Of course.
Show me all the blueprints. I want to get this done right, so show me all the blueprints. Show me all the blueprints.
Whatever the case, though, I mean, Taxi Driver is the movie that brought us Travis Bickle. I don't know much more you need to say. It's just amazing. Honestly, number 4, my favorite period of Scorsese, if I'm being honest with myself, is actually the Leonardo DiCaprio period.
All right.
Which is why number 4 is Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, okay.
I think there's so much that's so perfect about that movie. I think we don't have enough distance from it yet to realize how brilliant and important a film Wolf of Wall Street is. I think one day we will.
That's cool.
But right now, it's still kind of too fresh.
Yeah.
Jordan, the character, is one of the most beautifully realized characters. And I realize Leonardo DiCaprio finally got his Oscar for The Revenant, and that's great. For me, this is the best he's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
This is the performance. This is the film. Amazing.
I got to say, I'm incredibly excited to be a part of your firm. I mean, the clients you have are absolutely
top. Fuck the clients.
Your only responsibility is to put meat on the table. Name of the game, move the money from your client's pocket into your pocket.
Right, but if you can make a client's money at the same time, it's advantageous to everyone, correct?
No.
3, 2, and 1 are in a dead heat, and
yeah.
I don't know how to do it, but...
Say them all.
I'm going to say number 3, Raging Bull. I mean, can you make a better movie than Raging Bull?
I know.
It's perfection. I've led film groups, and I've been like, look... There's a couple movies you have to watch if you even want to like associate with me.
Yeah.
One of them's Doctor Strangelove. Another of them is Raging Bull. You have to watch the movie. It's just too good. And 2, I actually gave to Goodfellas.
All right.
If you want to drive yourself crazy, watch Goodfellas and then watch Miller's Crossing and try and figure out what the perfect gangster movie is.
Yeah, that's good.
You'll go bananas. The 2 perfect gangster movies that exist. I'll tell you, man, honestly, my number 1, and I'm just going to embrace it, for me, is The Departed.
Love it. Yeah, great.
I think it's the best thing he's ever done.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ensemble is just amazing. The screenplay is absolutely crackerjack. It's right on.
It is.
Maybe with the exception of Raging Bull, but it's maybe the best Thelma Schoonmaker's ever been.
Oh, the editing in that film is unbelievable.
It's just unreal.
And it brings up questions. You know... See, Bill, like, you're the new guy.
Is this something that you just want to go ahead and ask me? Because I'll give you the fucking answer, all right? Frank, look at me. Look at me. I'm not the fucking rat, okay?
Start with you agree there is a rat.
You said there is one, all right? I base most of what I do on the idea that you're pretty fucking good at what you do.
Like I said, honoraries to The Aviator, to The Last Temptation of Christ, and to The King of Comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like torture, honestly, coming up with this kind of list. Because, like, in any other context, saying The King of Comedy doesn't quite make the list, it's that's like, it's a testament to how amazing an artist Martin Scorsese does. I can't say that the guy never does anything wrong, but I mean, holy cow. Yeah. It's just, how is it that we have a guy this good?
I love it. This is so good.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, you and I from episode, what, 2 or 3 our first season have been talking about our desire to sit and have an honest-to-goodness Martin Scorsese conversation. He's one of these guys that you can't really, with a clear head almost, talk about who he is and what he means to the history of film and to the art form. He's too big. It's too much. I don't know. In some ways, I just feel like this discussion could have easily been twice as long as it is.
I know. It's a shame that it has to end.
Yeah. So, who's that knocking at my door?
Are we back there again?
Freshman film of Martin Scorsese.
So, I mean, one of the questions we try to answer is this, you know, is this something that people should see, or is it for completists only?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say yes and yes. I think the completist question is interesting with Martin Scorsese because, you know, and we've said this about other directors, yeah, you should see everything they do. Martin Scorsese, it's a little different, though, because saying you should see everything he does, that's no small thing to say.
No.
That's an undertaking. That's like saying, yeah, that's a master's course that you should take for the next year, you know? It's hard for me to picture a context in which an overview or a discussion of the artist Martin Scorsese isn't a part of why you would want to see Who's That Knocking at My Door. I'm comfortable calling it a completist film. I think it is. I think absent of a Martin Scorsese discussion, I think that's where the value of that film is. Mm-hmm. If you're going to see a Martin Scorsese movie that you haven't seen yet, I mean, there's just almost literally scores of movies that you need to see. But yeah, I mean, you know, and I hate calling a film that he's done a completist movie, but I feel okay saying that.
You know, I've never been actually more clear on this answer.
Yeah.
Because I usually have a hard time. I'm like, oh, I don't know where to put it. But I think it is completist. Mm. And the reason I feel so confidently saying that is because I think he's made this film in better ways.
Yeah.
In Mean Streets.
Sure.
And beyond. At some point, if you love Scorsese, you're going to watch it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's the place to start. I don't think it's the film you need to see.
Right.
I say that loving the artist, you'll get there eventually.
Yeah. So Daniel, back when we were wrapping up our season one, this was one of like the big heavy questions. Are we going to do a season two? I don't think it's as heavy a question for us this time around. You and I have seen that we've gone through 30 directors at this point, and there's still too many directors.
There's still more.
Yet to talk about, right?
Yeah, there really is. I mean, I don't feel like our conversation is done.
Yeah.
I want to keep going.
We are going to have a season three. Much like our season one to season two transition, though, we're going to need to take a little bit of time off.
Mm-hmm.
We both have life circumstances that are demanding our time
growing
and attention.
Growing families.
And to that end, we've had to accelerate our recording schedule to make sure that we had a full roster of episodes to come out most of the rest of this year. So season three, I say we do it.
Let's do it.
We're going to need to get a little bit into 2019 before we get into our next season. But Daniel, you and I have already talked about some of the episodes we want
to
do.
I feel like we're ready to go. We already know what episode 31 will be.
31? We know. We already got it. 32 we've talked about.
I know.
You know what? And
true.
We've even had discussions about what's the season three closer.
Which, oh, man.
I realize that's not even going to happen for like a year and a half from now, but I'm already jazzed about it.
Episode 45. We know it. It's true. We talked about it. I think we talked about it last season.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
Here we go.
Here we go. So please keep an ear out. You've already heard us talk about some of the specials that we want to get to. We've gotten some great anticipatory notes about our eventual superhero episode.
Ooh,
still
anytime.
Plan on doing it.
Anytime.
But listen, I did want to say this. If you've been faithful, you've been hanging with us for 30 episodes now and however many specials, thank you. thank you for listening from the bottom of our hearts. You're the reason that we love doing this. We love the in-person interaction, emails, Facebook notes, all of that. Daniel and I are two guys that just love talking about films. And so, no, there's just no way in hell we're going to give up. After two seasons, there's too many great directors, there's too many great films, too many interesting topics to talk about.
No, it's true, and we love sharing it with you, like the people who listen to it, and the people who share with us and talk with us. It's a gift to know that two guys talking in a room with headphones on into a recorder, people are interested in that. Yeah. So thank you for taking the time to listen to us, and it means a lot. I'm just glad to be in conversation with you, Jeremy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a fun thing.
It really is. This is, you know, we started this in mid-2016, and here we're getting ready to close out 2018.
It's crazy.
And this is still one of my favorite things that we do each month.
It really is the best.
It's super fun. Also, thank you to our wives, who are very accommodating to all the time that goes into doing this. Carrie Bear, I love you very much. Thanks for being cool about staying at home with little people while I go and record and go and watch movies to prepare to record and all that. It means an awful lot.
True. And Mandy Long, I think I said this today to her. She's my hero. Two little people, growing one of them in her womb.
Although by the time this episode drops,
she, our little girl, will be here.
Will have dropped also.
Oh, man. So, crazy time. Yeah. Certainly my hero. Grateful to her for allowing this to happen. It's a cool thing.
It's a cool thing. Freshman 15 listeners, thank you so much. We look forward to talking with you in 2019. Stay tuned. Skiddle-a-do, I said, skid out and bye. Skiddle-a-do, I said.